Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. Across the country, more than 200 people have been able to use DNA evidence to show that they had been imprisoned for violent crimes they did not commit. In fact, in most states, the law says that inmates indeed should have access to this kind of evidence. However, there are limits on access to DNA evidence that might show that someone had been wrongly convicted. And in fact, in a recent ruling, the United States Supreme Court declared that there was no constitutional right to such evidence. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a scholar who's done a lot of writing and research on post-conviction DNA testing. And in fact, his work was cited in two recent Supreme Court cases. Our guest for the program is Brandon Garrett. He is a professor of law, associate professor of law at the University of Virginia, and is interested in a number of things, including civil rights, criminal procedure, and wrongful conviction. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking about how the criminal justice system handles the cases of people found innocent through post-conviction DNA testing, and take whatever questions people have. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief in their comments and that they are relevant to the topic, but otherwise, people are welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good for anybody who would otherwise have to pave the call because they were calling long distance, and that number is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions and comments certainly are welcome. Professor Garrett, hello.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks very much for talking on us. We certainly appreciate it. Certainly, people will know that in recent years, there have been a number of very high-profile cases where someone who was convicted of a serious crime, some cases as serious as murder, was exonerated by DNA evidence. At the same time, we also know that there are people in prison right now arguing that they're not guilty, who've asked for DNA testing on evidence used to convict them and who've been turned down or who've been forced to wait for a long period of time. Do you have any idea, does anybody have any idea how many people like that there are?
We don't know. We know that many of these people who were eventually found innocent waited a long time to get DNA testing. The wait is shorter now because most states now have procedures to get DNA evidence post-conviction. There are certainly people who ask for DNA testing, and it turns out that they're guilty, and the DNA evidence proves it. But we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of people and not thousands, mostly because there are not that many cases where DNA testing can give you dispositive proof on the question of innocence. It's typically rape cases where you know if there's semen on the evidence, it came from the rapist, unless there's some other explanation for why there would be multiple sources of semen on the evidence. So it's typically been rape cases. Another reason why there haven't been that many old cases reopened is that a lot of police departments did not routinely save evidence from criminal cases back in the 80s, before DNA testing was being done routinely. In fact, many departments would routinely destroy everything after the appeal was over. They saw no reason to save it.
I think that one of the reasons that prosecutors object to this kind of review, post-conviction review, is they do indeed say something like, well, if we do this, it's not going to tell us that the person that has been convicted was not guilty of the crime. At best, it might say, well, it raises some doubt. And I guess that goes back to the question perhaps you've already answered. That is, in how many cases this post-conviction testing is likely to say the person who is sitting there in jail is not guilty? Or is it more likely it say, well, this causes us to doubt whether the person is guilty.
Right. Maybe it makes sense to even talk about the Osborne case and the facts in that case. I do think it's changed. There are not very many prosecutors anymore that vigorously oppose DNA testing like the prosecutors did in Alaska in Osborne's case. If you look at these DNA exonerations, there have been 240 of them, and some of the data that was before the court that I collected showed that, you know, in almost all the cases, you know, more than 80%, prosecutors at least eventually consented to the DNA testing. Mm-hmm. And one reason why is that in more than 40% of these exonerations, the DNA testing doesn't only say that, look, the person who was convicted was not the rapist, but it's identified the actual perpetrator through one of the DNA databases.
So in more, just to make sure that people hear that right, you're saying that in more than 40% of the cases, not only does it say the person who was convicted was not guilty, but it actually made it possible to identify who the guilty party was.
Right, and that's sort of another new technological advance. Not only has DNA testing changed a lot and improved a lot over the 1990s, by the middle of the 1990s, you had very advanced DNA testing like we have today. But with that new advanced DNA testing, starting in the 90s, the FBI first, and then the states created DNA databanks. And those databanks have grown massive. You know, there are now millions of profiles in this combined system of databanks, and law enforcement can access it and run a quick search to see whether a DNA profile in a particular case matches anyone. And these days, the databanks are growing incredibly large because they're taking DNA from people convicted of felonies. They're now even taking DNA from people just arrested, not even convicted of anything, which raises, you know, privacy concerns. But regardless, the databanks are big, and law enforcement often solves crimes using those databanks, including crimes where someone else had been convicted already.
Mm. Let me just very quickly again introduce our guest. The guest this morning in this hour of focus is Brandon Garrett. He is associate professor of law at the University of Virginia, has written a good deal of research, done a lot of research and writing on this particular area, and that is wrongful conviction and post-conviction DNA testing. And in fact, in a couple of recent cases by the Supreme Court, his work was cited. We'll talk some more about that as we continue. The number for callers, 333-9455, and a toll-free, 800-222-9455. There are four states, I believe, only four, or maybe I should say it the other way. There are 46 states that have laws that say that inmates have the right to do this testing. But there are four, I think that I'm right here, there are four that are not, that don't. And one of them is Alaska, and that's the state that this decision, the Osborne case, comes from. So maybe you want to talk a little bit about what are the basics of this case?
I do. You know, Alaska is really an unusual state. Not only is it one of the very few states that doesn't have a statute that says you can get post-conviction DNA testing, but it's the only state where post-conviction DNA testing has never been conducted, ever. Maybe because prosecutors in Alaska have never consented to it. You know, in the handful of other states that don't have statutes, Oklahoma, Massachusetts, prosecutors regularly agree to do the testing because they want to get at the truth. In Alaska, that has never happened. And so, you know, William Osborne was convicted of a crime in 1993. It was a serious rape and attempted murder. He was accused and then convicted of picking up a prostitute with another man named Jackson. And they had he and this co-defendant, Dexter Jackson, had solicited a prostitute, raped her, beat her, ordered her out of the car to lie in the snow, basically buried her in the Alaskan snow, and shot her in the head, leaving her for dead. It turned out the bullet only grazed her head. She lived, although it was in serious shock, understandably. What she had later said was that the passenger in this car that picked her up was the one that raped her vaginally with a blue condom she had with her. And that blue condom was found in the snow near where she was left for dead. Later on, this Jackson character confessed and said Osborne is the one that he did it with. The victim was shown Osborne in a lineup. And there were some questions there at that lineup because she had described the second person who attacked her as someone who was 25 to 30, 6 feet tall, 180, 190 pounds, and clean shaven. But Osborne was younger. He was only 21. He was only 5'9". He only weighed 155 pounds. And maybe most relevant, he had a big mustache. So big differences. And when she looked at the lineup, she looks at Osborne's photo in the lineup and says, he was the one who maybe looked most familiar, maybe most likely. So not a great eyewitness identification. And the trial lawyer thought that, you know, the eyewitness identification, it's cross-racial with a white victim and a black man. She thinks that maybe she can really poke holes in that eyewitness identification and convince the jury that the eyewitness wasn't being reliable. At his trial, DNA testing was done on that condom. But at the time, DNA tests weren't very strong. They weren't very discerning. And so, you know, the best that the tests could show is that, you know, basically one out of six, one out of seven men could have been the perpetrator. There were some hairs at the scene. They couldn't say much with those either, although they tried. But basically on the strength of Jackson saying, look, Osborne's the one who did this with me, and the victim saying, Osborne is the man. I recognize him. He was convicted. But the story to the Supreme Court is that, you know, after his trial, DNA testing became much improved. His lawyer at trial even had access to some slightly more powerful DNA testing and decided not to do it. She thought it might prove her client guilty. She'd never done a DNA case before. She thought it was a bad idea. Osborne wanted the more powerful DNA testing at trial, but it was her decision to make in Alaska. And so the DNA testing was never done. Just this DNA testing that the state did, saying, oh, one out of seven people could have done the crime. And so it's only after his appeals are over, he says, you know, my lawyer should have asked for the good DNA testing. And not only that, but there's even better DNA testing now. By the mid-90s, they had modern STR DNA testing. And so if you've heard of DNA test results where they say, oh, you know, one out of billions or trillions of people could be expected to randomly match this DNA profile, that's the kind of, you know, DNA testing that can be done on just a few cells or a tiny spot of saliva or sweat. That's the kind of DNA testing that was developed in the mid-1990s. You could test tiny pieces of evidence, and you can get incredibly probative results based on scientific research with large population databases. That's what he wanted. You could even do testing on the hairs found at the scene, because they invented mitochondrial DNA testing, looking at mitochondria in the hair shaft, not even just nuclear DNA testing. So with all those new technologies, plus the DNA databanks, maybe they would get a hit on someone else in the DNA databank, Osborne argued. With all that technology now available, Osborne said, let's take a look back at that evidence from my trial, because I say I'm innocent. And he was denied every step of the way in the Alaskan courts. And then the Supreme Court heard his case, and they said he wasn't entitled to the DNA testing either.
Hmm. Just to take a step back, when he asked, he said, the evidence exists. Improved testing is possible. Let's do the testing, and this will establish my argument that I am not guilty of this crime.
Right.
When the courts in Alaska said no, did they actually give a reason, or did they even have to give a reason?
They gave reasons. The reasons were a little bit confusing, to say the least. It's interesting. By the time the case got to the Supreme Court, the state of Alaska conceded, we agree, this test could prove his innocence, no question. And, of course, they had to say that. They had relied on the blue condom at trial to show that William Osborne was guilty. Everyone agreed that that blue condom was worn by the person who raped the victim, the second passenger in the, you know, in the car. What the courts of Alaska had said was, well, we don't have a DNA statute entitling you to this, which is true. And they said, well, the Supreme Court has never said you're constitutionally entitled to this, which was true. And they said, well, you know, maybe the state constitution in Alaska would entitle someone to get evidence of their innocence. But we're not sure it would in this case because basically we think Osborne is guilty. You know, they didn't have a statute, so they didn't have a lot to work with. They also didn't like the fact that his lawyer had a chance to ask for better testing, at least at the time, and decide not to do it. They said, you know, the lawyer made a strategic choice. Osborne is bound by his lawyer's decision. They also suggested, well, you know, maybe this isn't even new evidence of innocence, because after all, everyone knew about the blue condom at trial. They sort of dodged the issue that, well, there's much better technology now. DNA testing in the late 90s is very, very different than DNA testing in 1993. Mm-hmm. So those are the kinds of reasons that the Alaska courts made. They also emphasized that Osborne had confessed, because when he applied for parole, after 2000, I think, the only way you can get parole is if you acknowledge and accept your responsibility. And so he did that by confessing. And they said, well, he confessed. And, you know, Osborne's position was, well, I did that to try to get out. And, you know, I've said all along that I'm innocent.
And one of, as I mentioned, there are these 46 states that have laws saying that inmates do have the right to have these tests done. But I think that there certainly are a number of exceptions. And it is the case, I think, in I don't know how many places, but in various places that says if someone has confessed, then they're not eligible to have this testing done.
In some states, well, for example, there's litigation in Pennsylvania right now where some of the Pennsylvania courts have said that. Most of the statutes don't say that because everyone knows that, you know, there have been false confession cases where people confess even in great detail, and it turns out they're innocent. I've just finished a study looking at those false confessions. What a bunch of states do say is that if someone pleaded guilty, they can't get DNA testing post-conviction. It's not clear what the reason is for those statutes, but the idea seems to be similar, that if they pleaded guilty, they represented that they were guilty in court, they shouldn't be able to get the DNA. Of course, you know, there have been people who pleaded guilty found innocent by DNA testing. The Supreme Court decision was really interesting and strange, though, because actually I guess I would disagree with one thing you said about it. The Supreme Court really did recognize a constitutional right to DNA testing post-conviction. They actually did say, they said that, you know, William Osborne had a liberty interest in demonstrating his innocence with new evidence under state law. So they recognized an important new due process interest. But they said that William Osborne gets no relief under that interest. So that's what makes Chief Justice Roberts' opinion for the majority really complicated and interesting. They say, you know, the Constitution does have something to say about DNA testing post-conviction. It's just that, you know, no luck for William Osborne.
Well, then I guess I would have to say that I find that confusing. Maybe other people would find it confusing, too, because it sounds as if the court is saying, yes, there is such a right, but that the state of Alaska doesn't really have to do anything about it.
You know, the weirdest part about the decision was that they said, so due process would really say something if the state arbitrarily denied someone DNA testing. And they said, look, the state of Alaska, the courts looked at his claim. They have some kind of procedure here, even if they don't have a statute. They've said maybe under some circumstances you can get DNA testing. And if they had treated Osborne arbitrarily and denied him DNA testing for some arbitrary reason, then we would have a serious problem. And that's an important part of the decision, and that might affect other states. But they then say, well, they didn't treat William Osborne arbitrarily because he never asked for the modern DNA testing that he's now seeking. And that was a very, very strange part of the opinion because it was very clear on the record that William Osborne did ask for modern DNA testing. In fact, in the record before the court, the joint appendix, they have his state court briefs there. And in the briefs, he says, I want mitochondrial DNA testing. I want short tandem repeat STR DNA testing. The modern forms that were not available at the time of his trial. He asked for them repeatedly throughout the state court process. And yet, strangely, the Supreme Court says, well, you know, he could very well get the testing if he only asked for it. He didn't ask for it right. So why should we, you know, the state didn't treat him arbitrarily. So, you know, the result in the majority opinion turns on a factual error. It's very strange.
Do you think that the court was influenced in some part also by the fact that now most states actually do address this, and perhaps the court was saying, well, this shows that this can and should be a matter for states to resolve, and most states have, and so for that reason, we really don't need to get involved.
So there's a lot of language there, that's right, where the Supreme Court says, you know, we don't need to overly constitutionalize the issue. We have 46 states with statutes governing post-conviction DNA testing. They cite an article of mine where I go through those statutes in some detail, and they list the states that have statutes, and they say, look, this is an area that the states are really taking care of. It involves new technology, difficult choices that states have to make, policy choices, choices that are probably too difficult for the Supreme Court to really get involved in, particularly since it takes years for cases to reach the court. And I think that, you know, a lot of those concerns are really valid concerns. I mean, this is the first time a case has gotten to the court where someone was asking for DNA testing. It's been years, you know, that DNA testing has been around. And you know, most of these statutes were enacted in the states just in the last 5 years. You know, the Supreme Court moves very slowly. It's probably not the right body to be providing a lot of detailed regulation for DNA testing. Hmm. Of course, that's not what Osborne was asking for. He wasn't asking for detailed regulation. He just said that if a state categorically refuses to give DNA testing, that's arbitrary.
There are four states that don't have the kinds of laws dealing specifically with this thing that we're talking about, post-conviction DNA testing. One of them, we have talked about, that's Alaska. The others are Alabama, Massachusetts, and Oklahoma.
Right.
In these states, is there any movement towards enacting the same kind of laws that exist in the other 46?
There is. In fact, there was legislation introduced in Alaska, which may get passed now. I remember seeing, you know, one state legislator in Alaska saying something to the effect of, you know, we'll wait to see what the Supreme Court does, and depending what happens, we may introduce legislation in Alaska. Oklahoma had legislation, but it expired. It was sort of time-limited, and it expired after a few years. Although the issue hasn't come up in Oklahoma so much, because prosecutors there have tended to agree to DNA testing. And same thing in Massachusetts, actually. Prosecutors have regularly consented to DNA testing, so it just hasn't come up that often. In Alabama, there are a couple cases where, like Osborne, the person says, look, DNA could show my innocence, and they've been unable to get it. But there have been bills introduced in some of these states that don't have statutes yet. There's a whole separate problem where some of the states that do have statutes which are very restrictive. And actually, that in some of those states, there might be a better argument that it violates due process, that it's arbitrary.
Mm-hmm. Well, just for I want to talk about that, but just for a moment, if the Alaska legislature should pass a law, a DNA testing law, would that help Mr. Osborne? Or as a result of the decisions up to this point,
right,
they would say, well, sorry, Mr. Osborne, you're out of luck.
Right. What's going to happen to Osborne? You know, he has a few options. He might get relief under a new statute. Most of these statutes are specifically designed to apply to old cases, so they're not going to be able to, you know, they're not going to exclude him in the statute. The whole point of these statutes is to conduct testing, you know, mostly in cases dating back to the 1980s before DNA testing was widely used, or at least, you know, the early 90s, like Osborne. He has a couple of other options. One thing he can do is go back to the state courts and say, you know, to the extent that you were confused and you didn't understand that I was asking for new DNA testing that was not available at trial, I repeat, I'm asking for new DNA testing. And the Supreme Court said, I should ask you first if I'm asking for new DNA testing. I thought I asked before. I'm asking again. He could try that. The second thing he could try, the Supreme Court also said that he could file a habeas petition and include in that petition a claim saying, I'm actually innocent, and say, look, I need discovery from the court. The only way I can prove my innocence is to get DNA testing. And the majority opinion suggested that he do that, as did a concurring opinion. So that's another possibility for him.
We have talked about the fact that there are now these 46 states that have laws that say that inmates do have the right to these tests. However, there are some places where there certainly are restrictions that, and perhaps where prosecutors aren't complying, or maybe they aren't complying with deliberate speed. In those places where these laws do exist, how well are they working?
You know, it's hard to say. There's certainly evidence from some states that people who are entitled to testing aren't getting it. And so you'll see some states that have very sensible statutes that just say, if there's a reasonable likelihood that DNA testing could show someone's innocence, then they should get the testing. But all they're asking is, you know, could the testing shed light on innocence, which certainly makes sense to require. But some of those states have had courts issue decisions saying, well, the victim might have had a boyfriend, therefore, the DNA testing might not tell us anything. We're denying relief. Of course, you know, you could conduct the DNA testing and get testing to eliminate the boyfriend. Or, you know, otherwise exclude some boyfriend theory. You could, you know, these courts weren't even asking whether the victim had a boyfriend, right? It was just a hypothetical designed to avoid having to conduct the testing. There's some states where they limit DNA testing and exclude people who pleaded guilty. And there's a couple states where the only people who can get DNA testing are people who are sentenced to death. So that leaves out a lot of very serious felonies. So, you know, some of these statutes have problems, and some of these statutes have been interpreted by courts in really strange and arbitrary ways. And to the extent that Osborne says that if a state provides procedures, it can't act in an arbitrary way, the Osborne case actually might have some real power to try to challenge the state court statutes and rulings that make those kinds of arbitrary distinctions. Mm.
And would it be your argument that I wouldn't perhaps want to say anyone who asks, but anyone who has been found guilty and is in prison for a serious crime, we're talking about something like rape or murder, that anyone like that should be able to have access to the DNA testing?
Well, I think anyone who could prove their innocence using the DNA testing. I mean, it's sort of circular to say, well, they should have evidence of their innocence before they get the DNA testing, because, of course, the whole reason they need the DNA testing is that they can't otherwise prove their innocence. But, you know, there's some cases where the DNA testing couldn't possibly say anything about innocence. So if there's a piece of biological evidence from the crime scene, a bandana, but there's no evidence that it came from the attacker. In fact, it might have came from a park where there was all kinds of clothing all over the place. Right, that piece of evidence isn't going to be probative. It doesn't matter whose DNA is on it. It's not going to tell you anything about the attacker. There are many rape cases, for example, where the assailant was an acquaintance of the victim. And so you could do DNA testing, but there isn't an issue about who had sexual intercourse with the victim. The issue in the case is whether there was consent, you know, whether it was a rape or not, right? And that's how most rape cases are litigated, surrounding issues of consent. It's only in cases involving stranger attackers, stranger rape cases, that the main question is, who is the stranger? What is the identity of the person who did this? So in identity cases, DNA testing can be very powerful. But actually, even in most rape cases, DNA testing doesn't play a big role because everyone agrees that this is the person who had intercourse with the victim. The question is, was it consensual or not?
Yeah. And just we're just about at our midpoint here, and I want to take the time to reintroduce you and our topic. But I guess, again, to come back to something that I mentioned at the beginning, the kind of research that you've done and that was in fact cited when the arguments were made before the Supreme Court says that if you look at post-conviction DNA testing and you ask this question, well, what purpose does this serve? You can say in a substantial number of cases that, one, it shows that the person who had been convicted was not guilty, and two, in many cases, and I think you said the number was something around 40%, it actually identifies the person, the person who actually committed the crime. So if one asks the question, well, is there really good reason to do this testing and give inmates access to this kind of testing, your answer would be yes, and I can show you that.
Oh, yes. So my argument would be that a DNA testing can tell us the truth, and not only can it free the innocent, but like the Supreme Court said, it's more commonly used to identify the guilty. And not just before trial. You know, before trial, DNA testing is used in thousands and thousands of cases every year, tens of thousands of cases, and it's often used to prove guilt. It's just in this handful, you know, hundreds of cases post-conviction where it's used to prove innocence. But out of those 240 exonerations, more than 100 have involved cases where the guilty person was identified by the post-conviction DNA testing. And some of those people were serial rapists, serial murderers, who had gone on to convict to commit many more crimes, apprehending those people was a really significant accomplishment and very important to public safety. These were people that had gone on to commit multiple crimes and might have continued to do so had not the post-conviction DNA testing been conducted. And so I think that's one of the reasons why law enforcement has really changed its tune, and for the most part is eager to conduct the testing. And actually, in Osborne's case in Alaska, the local police department dropped out of the briefing, basically, and is happy to conduct the DNA testing. It's the state and the prosecutor that continue to oppose the DNA testing.
The guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Brandon Garrett. He's associate professor of law at the University of Virginia. He's interested in a number of things, including civil rights, criminal procedure, wrongful conviction. He's done a lot of research and writing on the subject of post-conviction DNA testing. And in fact, in a recent Supreme Court case, his work was cited. In fact, in two recent cases, his work was cited. And we're talking about that this morning. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I thought we might just talk for a minute about this this other case. It's a little bit different, but I suppose it does have to do with the way that evidence in criminal cases is presented. And this was also a case in which your work was cited. And that has to do with expert witnesses. And once people have given their expert opinion on something, some key piece of evidence, I guess in some places that it was allowed that the report from that person could be submitted in court, and that was that. And what in this particular case, what the court said was, no, that the person, the expert who has signed off on this evidence must actually appear in court and be there so that he or she could be cross-examined by the attorneys representing the accused.
It was really interesting that there were two cases before the Supreme Court this term that both dealt with forensic science issues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one case dealt with sophisticated DNA testing. The second case that you just mentioned, the Melendez-Diaz versus Massachusetts case, that case actually involved a more also an automated kind of test, but it was a test for the presence of cocaine. And that's actually conducted, you know, far more often than DNA tests. You know, DNA testing is a tiny percentage of what crime laboratories do each year. And a huge chunk of what they do, you know, maybe about half of what they do, is testing, seize drugs to see if it's really drugs or whether it's, you know, something innocuous, a bag of powdered sugar, I don't know. What many states had done was pass statutes saying, you know, we don't have to bring the forensic scientist into the trial. We'll just introduce a certificate, a piece of paper saying, I, the analyst, say it's cocaine. And that's basically what they would say. They wouldn't explain what they did, how they tested the evidence, or what they found. They would just sort of state the conclusion. The Sixth Amendment provides a right to confront adverse witnesses, and the Supreme Court said that the state is actually affirmatively obligated to put that witness on the stand. Obviously, you know, even without the Sixth Amendment obligation, the defense can call the witness themselves and subpoena them themselves, but as a result of the Supreme Court's ruling, the state actually has the affirmative obligation in the first place to make sure that that person is there.
Hmm. You know, one of the things that we have heard certainly a lot about over the past few months is how it is that the various crime labs across the country are just overwhelmed with the amount of evidence that they have to produce and analyze. And there are questions raised about just how good the quality of analysis is. And I think that some people have, some prosecutors have reacted to this decision and said this is a disaster. And in fact, I think the words that I know I read in some story was that it was a train wreck. And the thing that they're concerned about is that now these already overburdened labs are actually going to have to send their personnel to testify, to show up in person. They have to travel. They have to spend time in court. And one might argue that that's taking time away from doing the work that they're already overstressed to be able to do. Do you have any sort of sympathy to that kind of argument?
I do, and the work of these crime labs is important, and they do not have the resources that they need. I think Justice Scalia did an excellent job of talking about this, there are many other reasons why crime labs are overburdened. This isn't going to have much of an impact. And actually, some crime labs have even said that since, that it's not clear what impact this is going to have on them. And there are a few reasons. One is, very few criminal cases go to a trial. Almost all cases result in a guilty plea. It's a tiny percentage of cases that go to trial, and even a smaller percentage of those that involve not only a trial, but forensic science. Second, most criminal defendants don't want the guy testifying in court. Why? You know, does the defendant really want the DNA analyst to get on the stand and explain exactly why it is that only one person in trillions could be expected to randomly match the evidence? And do they really want the analyst to get on the stand and explain how all their machines work and how they are absolutely positive it's cocaine because their machine has been tested and has operated correctly in thousands of cases and has been validated using all the best instruments? You know, defendants don't want that. Most defendants would probably rather have the certificate rather than have this very convincing scientist on the stand. And so in most cases, defendants are going to stipulate. And most of the time the prosecution is going to agree to stipulate and just let the piece of paper be introduced so that the jury hears, yes, it was cocaine. Sometimes the prosecution may want the person on the stand anyway because they want the jury to hear that only one person in trillions could randomly match the DNA evidence. But for the most part, the parties are going to settle these questions because neither of them really want that expert on the stand. In a few cases, it may be important, though. And those are the cases that I'm worried about and that I've written about. But you also see this situation where prosecutors put someone on the stand, but it's someone in the crime lab who's really good at testifying, but who actually didn't conduct any of the relevant analysis and doesn't really know what work was done in the person's case. And that's troubling from a Confrontation Clause perspective, because if there really are questions about the work done in the lab and whether they interpreted the evidence right, in those kinds of cases, the defense should be able to ask questions of the person who did the work and who made the interpretations. And so I think that subset, probably a very small subset of cases, the Supreme Court's decision is really important.
We have a couple of callers here. We'll bring them into the conversation. We'll start with line number one. This is someone in Champaign.
Yes.
Yes, hello.
Hello. A while ago, I heard a program on your station about chimeras, people and animals that have two sets of DNA. I'm not too clear about the details, but they did mention that this might mess up DNA evidence and exonerate somebody incorrectly. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, and you know there's some suggestion that there's some forms of DNA which can mutate, and people, it hasn't come up in criminal cases that I've seen at least. And obviously, it's very easy to do multiple tests. Although, in most of these exoneration cases, they're only worried about DNA evidence in one place, right? They're not interested in whether, DNA evidence in someone's mitochondria in one place matches another place. They're only interested in semen, because semen is what was found at the crime scene, and they want to find out whether the defendant's semen has the same genetic profile or not. And so I guess for that reason, since they're focused on DNA from a very specific place, it's tended not to come up in the exoneration context.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, thank
All right.
you.
All right. Let's go to another caller. This is also someone in Champaign, and it's line two. Hello.
Hi. The one thing that concerns me about the Osborne case, and I think it's Alaska, if he didn't want it at first and now he does and they don't give it to him, then obviously there may be somebody out there they should be looking for.
Well, that's right. That's a real concern. Assuming his co-defendant did do it, but if Osborne didn't, that's right. There's this person involved in this incredibly gruesome crime who's still out there. If he did do it, we'll find out pretty quickly, and it'll be a lot uh-huh. cheaper to do this
right.
test than
so
to let him keep filing these appeals.
Alaska are both crazy.
Well, it's something I didn't even mention. The test is not expensive. Like most exonerees, he's represented by the Innocence Project. Most exonerees are represented by one Innocence Project or another. He happens to be represented by the one in New York at Cardozo Law School. And they've offered to pay for the test.
Hmm.
So there's no cost to Alaska.
Right.
The tests are a lot cheaper these days. A single test might be a lot less than $1,000. A few tests might be a couple $1,000. The test is not going to cost them much.
Mm-hmm.
Litigating this case to the Supreme Court, that probably cost them a lot.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay.
So.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Well, I think that there the caller puts her finger on why it is that these cases can be so upsetting to communities where horrible crimes have been committed, because what it says, I don't know that people are all that concerned, maybe they are, that someone was unjustly imprisoned. The thing that really does concern them is that it means that the person who indeed committed the crime is probably still at liberty. And the question of who the guilty party is still an open question.
Yes, although, we certainly have seen communities say that we have a conviction, we'd like it to remain final. you used to have a lot of rules that would say that, look, we don't reopen old criminal cases to look at innocence and guilt. We settled that at the time of trial. It's settled. It's final. And some of the justices made remarks, you know, saying, you know, we've traditionally believed in finality in this country. And there are a lot of reasons why you don't want to just reopen judgments over and over again. It has to end at some point. But that's, you know, DNA is different. And that's why states have mostly passed these statutes. DNA testing is much more accurate than the evidence at a trial typically. And you can do the testing decades later. It's really unusual that you have something that produces more accurate results years later. You know, normally, years later, people's memories fade, evidence might get lost, things get less accurate over time. DNA is really different.
You talked a little bit earlier about there would have been a point going back far enough when a case was concluded, a person was convicted, they were sent to jail, the evidence was destroyed. They didn't keep it because the assumption was that they had gotten the guilty party and that there was no particular reason. Well, are we now saving everything?
There's sort of a patchwork of laws. You know, and part of it was that the evidence was often not saved because they didn't think there was anything there. You know, before DNA testing, you couldn't tell much from the evidence. You know, you could test rape kits and find out maybe the blood type of the attacker, but that tended not to be particularly exciting evidence. You'd find out, oh, the attacker is a type O, and 40% of the population is type O. And so, you know, departments had limited space. They didn't save the stuff. Many departments did routinely save everything, and that's the reason why we can do DNA testing in a lot of these old cases. But some states, Virginia, routinely destroyed evidence once the conviction was final, and many local police departments did that. The reason why we've had so many exonerations in Dallas, in part, is because that police department routinely saved everything. Now, about half the states have passed laws requiring preservation of evidence. But some of those laws say that, well, the defendant has to specifically request preservation. And that's the reason why the rape kit in William Osborne's case is still around. He requested that it be preserved, and so there's a court order saying that it has to be preserved. But let's say, you know, that the prosecutors ignore the court order and just destroy the evidence anyway. Typically, there's no consequence for that, unless you could show that they did it on purpose, willfully, and that can be hard to show. Maybe in Osborne's case, if they did it on purpose after the Supreme Court decision, he could get some relief based on that. But if after the Supreme Court decision, it turned out that they'd been keeping the evidence in an unsafe building and the building collapsed and destroyed everything, if it was just negligence, you know, that there would be no consequences for that.
We just mentioned, and this is something that we've certainly talked about here on the program, some of the criticism that has been made of crime labs around the country, the people that are doing the forensic analysis on evidence to try to determine who is and who is not guilty. And there has been some really serious criticism about the procedures that are carried out and how well they're carried out, the training that the people who work in the labs have, the fact that they're truly overburdened so that they're behind in analyzing a lot of the material. There isn't the kind of oversight or regulation or quality control perhaps that there should be. Do you think that we have made any sort of progress towards dealing with these sorts of things?
I think significant progress needs to be made. The Melendez-Diaz opinion quoted at length a report by the National Academy of Science that came out earlier this year, which described just a whole series of problems and basically said that there needs to be wholesale structural reform of our entire forensic science system in this country. They said that there needs to be established a National Institute of Forensic Science to fund basic research that's needed, that you know there have been techniques used in courtrooms to convict people for years and years and years that are not supported by sound science and that need to be further supported, and that there need to be standards for what analysts say when they reach conclusions, that there are just sort of all sorts of different conclusions being reached around the country, some supported by science, some not, and that these labs need basic support, like financial support, and even just you know common standards so that they're not using different systems that are incompatible. So there are all kinds of issues that crime labs face, and you know they're in the wake of that National Academy's report, Congress has held hearings, and legislation will hopefully be introduced. And you know, one would hope that it would be an important priority. This is sort of something that's shovel-ready. It's incredibly important. This administration has said that it cares about science and restoring the place of science in our country. So there are all sorts of reasons why reform legislation is crucial. Hopefully it'll pass, and hopefully it'll produce some kind of real oversight. There's an example of poor use of forensic science just in the Osborne case. Hairs were found at the crime scene. And hair evidence involves looking at hairs under a microscope to see what kind of characteristics they have. And that's basically it. The hair, you can put hairs side to side and say, are they similar or are they not? Typically sets of hairs, and so they look at characteristics over a bunch of hairs. They found a bunch of hairs on the victim's sweater in that case, and they took some hairs from Osborne, and they looked at them side by side. And the analyst actually said the right thing. The analyst said, look, Osborne's hairs are consistent with the ones found at the crime scene. I can't say anything more than that. Because there is no database on hair. No one knows how many people have curly hair versus hairs with little spheres in the centers or clear follicles or not. All they can say is that they look alike. They look similar. But interestingly, the district attorney in that case extended the science in his closing arguments and said, and you heard from the scientist, Osborne's hairs were found at the scene. And they weren't found at the scene. Hairs that were kind of similar were found at the scene. What does that mean, that they were similar? Hard to say. Just that they're consistent. That was one of the things the National Academy said. We need national standards, because when an analyst says the hairs were consistent, that's confusing terminology. What does consistent mean? Maybe the prosecutor was even confused, and that's why he said, oh, Osborne's hairs were found at the scene. They said there were vague terms like that these analysts use. Really, what consistent means is that the hairs look a lot alike, but I can't tell you, do 10,000 people have hairs just like this? Do millions of people have hairs just like this? We don't know. All we know is that these hairs look alike. What that actually tells you, we can't say. You know, it's very subjective, and it's not even clear, you know, how much weight a jury should give testimony like that. And yet it happens, you know, all the time in our courts. What Justice Scalia cited was an article that I wrote with Peter Neufeld, the co-director of the Innocence Project, where we looked back at what happened in all the criminal trials of people who were exonerated by DNA testing. So we know they're innocent. What did forensic analysts say at their trials? Did they properly present the evidence given the state of the science at the time? Or did they say things that were unscientific? And what we found was that most of the time, more than most, you know, 60% of the time, analysts misstated the science. And usually the defense didn't even really notice or realize what had happened. And so they would say things like, well, you know, only 5% of the population could be expected to have a hair with this unusual hair color. And they couldn't say that. There are no statistics on hair. They made up statistics. Or in other cases, they calculated statistics wrong or reached conclusions that were subjective and not supported by science. So, you know, those kinds of scientific misstatements were just pervasive in these innocent people's trials. You know, how big a role it played in their trial is hard to say, but it suggests that there's a real need for national standards.
We just have about 2 minutes left. I have two callers. I'm afraid I won't be able to take them both, but we'll try to take one, and we'll take them in the order they came in. So that means we'll first go to Belgium, line four. Hello.
Hello, and I'm afraid the question I was going to have probably would go in a direction that would take too long. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, I guess we can then try and go to line number one here, Champaign County.
Very gracious. I wanted you to reprise your line that in this last moment, that there was actually an error of fact in the argument that that the Supreme Court used to turn it down, that he did actually ask for these tests.
Yeah.
That's astonishing to me. Is there any kind of redress? Can they have a similar case at the Supreme Court level and then act on it and maybe in any way affect this case?
Justice Souter even pointed it out in his dissent. And it was very strange. Even early in the majority opinion, at one point they noted, well, it's unclear whether he requested the new DNA testing. But then they rely on the fact later on this, you know, finding that he did not. I don't think that there's any redress at the court. He could ask for a rehearing. What it does suggest, though, is that the ruling is very narrow and based on a, you know, very narrow factual finding. It may mean that that the constitutional right is pretty broad because it has to be an unusual case where supposedly someone didn't even ask for the testing, where they're going to get denied relief under the Constitution. So maybe it's a good thing for future litigants that the ruling is based on something so narrow.
Did you want to follow up on that at all, Carl? Well, I hope at least we got at his question. Let me perhaps ask just one final thing, and that is, as we accumulate more and more DNA and evidence, and that is we put it into our DNA bank. You talked about the fact that, for example, you know, we're collecting a lot of evidence. We collect people from maybe people who are just arrested. We don't really know whether they've done anything in particular, but we're amassing this big bank of evidence. Do you think that that is good and that as a result there will be more accurate convictions? If we convict somebody, they really will have done it, and we'll have fewer of these cases where someone is convicted of a crime that he didn't commit?
I think there's every reason to think that, yes, DNA has made our system much more accurate. And we know that, you know, every year thousands of people are cleared by DNA evidence before there's ever a trial. You know, we don't want people to have to be exonerated. Much better for everyone to realize that a mistake was made early on so that they can catch the right person without convicting the wrong person. And so, you know, DNA evidence has become much more routine. Unfortunately, though, you know, we still have wrongful convictions, even ones resulting in DNA exonerations in the DNA era. And part of the reason is that sometimes the state just doesn't do the DNA testing. Sometimes there are slip-ups, and the defense never finds out that there was evidence to test, and neither does the state. And the crime lab sort of loses track of it. And we've had cases where the DNA testing was done incorrectly. And when the testing was redone, it was very clear that a mistake had been made, you know, sort of crime lab slip-ups. And so, you know, it's still important that we have these statutes and that we look at cases post-conviction.
Yeah. Our guest, I'm afraid I'm going to have to jump in on you there. Brandon Garrett is Associate Professor of Law at University of Virginia. And thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.